Nick is an example to us all, especially to you Reuters fellows, because he was a Reuters fellow a year or so ago from the BBC. So you're having another, having had a BBC talk today chaired by a BBC man in an institute which is led by a BBC man. You've now got a BBC man.
X.
Soon there'll be lots of ex-BBC people.
That cheery sort.
Nick is now a freelance and he's a consultant on digital issues. He spent many years in the BBC and he was crucial to their development, the development of their web strategy, especially on issues like, blogs and social media. When he was here, when he was a Reuters fellow, he's now a visiting fellow of the Institute, he did a working paper which was called The Rise of Social Media and the Impact on Mainstream Journalism, which I urge you to read. It was one of the first and still among the best sketches of what's happening to journalism under the impact of social media. And he's followed that up more recently with a study of the 2010 election, the general election in this country, mainstream media and the role of the internet, and the social and digital effects on the mainstream media's coverage of that. And though, as he notes, and those of you who know about that election will have seen, the old technology, if you can call TV an old technology, was still dominant, both that it got the a scandal involving the then Prime Minister and that it put on for the first time debates between the party leaders. Still, Nick's contention in this working paper, which you'll find on the website, is that the social and digital media had a considerable effect, if less dramatic effect, than television, especially in increasing the engagement, and especially increasing the engagement of the young, and that social media, digital media, Twitter and so forth, are now passing into and are now an established part of the way in which journalists approach the coverage of politics, showbiz, entertainment, and much else. So that's Nick's background. He's going to talk about social media and its place in journalism. As usual, we'll have 20, 30 minutes and then open it up for discussion. So many thanks to you, Nick.
Thank you very much, John. It's great to be here. I think the original title of this was Citizen Journalism. I've slightly recast that to include the word social media. So two reasons for that, really. So one is that so many of these things are very related. I think it's often confused, so you might as well deal with that up front, the fact that these things are closely related, but also because I think it helps to get to some of the fundamental issues that lie behind this. So the shift of control from publishers to consumers, which is expressing itself not just in citizen journalism, but in a whole array of developments which are disruptive to journalistic organisations, but also to the way in which journalism so social media, user-generated content, kind of terms. So what I'm going to do is talk a little bit about the sort of underlying changes, some of the reasons for it. I wanted to put some of it in context, so look at some of the statistics and put it in the context of overall media consumption. How significant is this really? Look at some examples of how mainstream media are reacting. So John talked about the election, so we'll look at some of those, but also other recent events to see how this is playing out here in the UK, but also elsewhere. And then finally, look into the future. So what have we learnt so far for the last 5 years or so of citizen journalism and social media? What might happen next? So I'm going to start with a slightly counterintuitive example. So this is a news story that you might think was the ultimate example of the continuing power of the traditional media. So the rescue of over 30 Chilean miners was something of a media circus. It sold millions of newspapers, a global media event. It had people glued to their television screens, not a citizen journalist in sight. But a bit like, as John was saying, with the TV debates in the election, under the skin of these enormous live events now, there is a huge amount of personal publishing, of personal activity, of social media, and of mainstream media as well incorporating all of these personal publications. And as a result, the back channel of what happened with the Chile miners was very much happening online in a way that wouldn't have happened with a similar event 5 or 10 years ago. And partly as a result, and I make the same point in the one about the election, audiences are engaged in a different way. They're engaged as never before. I think it contributed to that story, although it was, of course, absolutely made for traditional television, being bigger and also being sustained during the quiet periods for much longer in ways that would have happened before. So that's just example of one type of story. Here's an example of a different story. A news story that you can't plan for in the same way you can plan for a Chilean miners' rescue, where television actually had to take a back seat in many ways to citizens. Citizens certainly had a much bigger role in the Iranian protests of June 2009. And during those protests, you may remember, the mainstream media organisations were not able to get out into the streets. They were banned. They were confined to the hotel rooms. They were unable to cover the demonstrations. And so it was user-generated footage shot on mobile phones, distributed via social networks like YouTube, Facebook, which enabled things to be seen that hitherto would have been unseen, and which became, for a period at least, the sustaining service for traditional TV coverage all over the world. So it's, these were some of the pictures you may remember. This is Persian television with essentially running hours of mobile phone footage, which they had in from people in Iran, and CNN and other broadcasters did similar things. So the Iranian protests were the latest in a long line of stories where the first footage or pictures came from camera phones. So we had the plane in the Hudson, you may remember, taken on an iPhone, and then sent around the world, literally within 10 minutes or so, distributed by Twitter. In that particular case, you had the Mumbai attacks, where a lot of the early eyewitness came out through Twitter, Chinese earthquakes, a whole succession of stories where citizens were providing the eyewitness news using these new tools. Another really groundbreaking moment was the G20 process in April last year, which happened in London, and the story of Ian Tomlinson's death, who was a bystander actually, not a protester, and he got caught up in the scuffles, and the pictures of him being forced to the ground by police emerged later, a few days later, from footage that was shot by a New York banker who happened to be in the area at the time. It actually took a few days for the footage to come out. And what's interesting, and it says at the top of this, mix of old and new media attracting a global audience. It was very much the way in which traditional journalists, in this case Paul Lewis of The Guardian, used a lot of footwork and traditional methods, combining all the different eyewitness events, not just this video, and including this crucial video, which eventually gave The Guardian a global scoop and led to some of the subsequent stories. So I think it's another great example actually of how citizen journalism and social media tend not to put traditional journalism out of business. Rather, they can complement each other, and certainly they did on this occasion. Here's another different example, a third example of the emerging practice of citizen journalism. So this is my local website. I live in East London. It's staffed entirely by volunteer citizen journalists. It's just over a year old, and this is an example of a story that was broken by citizen journalists, not by the local paper. So the local paper didn't have this story of what they're calling a pie and smash in Wanstead. Is a pie and mash shop that had a brick through the window. It later turned out that actually this was arson. It was a real story, and it was picked up from the local paper, partly as a result of the picture and the initial digital footprint, which came from this local website. So we'll talk more about hyperlocal later, but I think there are lots of examples now where individual bloggers or groups of people are creating valuable content, valuable enterprises, and providing challenges to traditional media organizations. So three kind of different examples at the beginning there, sort of global, national, and local, planned, unexpected kind of stories, but all of them in some way touched by the voice of the citizen. So academics, writers like Paul Sappho talk about the shift from the passive citizen to the active citizen, and the rise of personal media in particular. This is a quote that I particularly liked, which talks about the transition from the sort of one-way broadcast view of the world to the two-way interactions that you have today. And the key phrase for me at the end there is that not everyone will want to take part in the possibilities, but we now expect to be able to answer back, or is the possibility that we can answer back, whether that's to mainstream media organisations or politicians or whatever it is. And what allows us to answer back are these incredibly powerful social tools which have emerged over the last few years, and they've been around so long we kind of think of them as being here for forever, but actually YouTube is only about 5 years old. If anyone's watched the Facebook movie, you'll know how recently, social networking, how recently all of that happened and how quickly that emerged. Twitter literally in the last 2 years. And so we can upload pictures to Flickr, audio to Audioboo, video, maybe about cats, or maybe about something more sensible to YouTube. And the key point is it's free and it's incredibly easy to do. So the last few years, most people have on the internet have tried some of these things and have found it easier than they expected. So whilst people have adopted these tools in their millions, the whole sort of trend is not without its critics. So people like Andrew Keane, who wrote The Cult of the Amateur, bemoan the decline in quality information and professional standards that he lays at the door of citizen journalism, the unreliability of those Twitter feeds, etc., all the rest of it. So for us as journalists, these trends require a lot of thought. They threaten to change the way we have practiced journalism for decades. Potentially, they threaten to damage the brands, to marginalise mainstream journalism, but they also open up new possibilities for journalists, that it can be more than a one-way broadcast, that we can use these tools to build new relationships and conversations with audiences. So before we talk about how mainstream media companies are reacting, I just wanted to look at some of the statistics. So to what extent is this activity really significant? Is it just a minority of people doing it? Is it passing fad? Apart from the quality criticisms that Andrew Keane talks about, there are also criticisms that it's just elites talking to each other, but it isn't really something of scale and significance. So what's the evidence? So this is the Oxford Internet Survey from the Oxford Internet Institute, just down the road. It comes out every 2 years, and it's documented an extraordinary increase in participation between 2007, which was its last survey, and the 2009 survey, which came out. Driven by those new tools, blogging, video creation, and all the rest. And pretty much every measure of participation is up. So if you just take social networking, which is probably the most telling statistic. So 17% of people in 2007 regularly updated or used a social networking profile. In 2009, it's 49%, and it'll be much higher than that today. So it essentially went from being a marginal activity to being a mainstream activity of internet users. Blogging, so it's a fairly staggering figure. Only 22% of people write a blog. There's 20% of people on the internet write a blog, up 12%. Over 50% of internet users read blogs. So another way of looking at this is where are people spending their time? And far more time is now spent creating or consuming personal media than consuming traditional media, and that's obviously a huge change. This chart shows the rise of Twitter, just as one example, against a global traditional publisher like CNN at the beginning of 2009. So the blue line is Twitter, and you can see in just a few months it went from nowhere to overtake in terms of unique users CNN. Facebook now has 500 million users worldwide. You know that if you've watched the film, which is an excellent film, by the way. Not only does it dwarf CNN in terms of unique numbers, but in terms of the amount of time spent. So for a traditional media company online, people spend maybe 5 minutes a day. That's the average for something like CNN or the BBC. For Facebook, people spend on average 25 minutes a day. Graph is gradually, or has been gradually, increasing. So five times as much time. And in total now, 20% of people's time, over 20% of people's time in the UK is spent on social networking sites online. So partly as a result, although we don't think of social networking sites and news sites or journalism sites competing, partly as a result, this is where people are spending their time, it's also increasingly where people are getting their information, where they're getting their news, as well as discussing it. So this was the death of Michael Jackson last year, breaking on Twitter. So the little spike is the hour or so when the rumours were flying around. I was in a pub in Oxford at the time. I wasn't on Twitter, I wasn't looking at Twitter, but somebody in the pub was, and so I got to know about it very quickly through that route. It was, of course, confirmed later by the BBC, about 5 or 6 hours later, so then I knew it was true. So the role of the mainstream media has become less now to break news, more to confirm the events that are happening, and to provide that element of that brand of trust and authenticity. So there may be questions about the reliability of the news here, but there's absolutely no doubting the speed. So all of this is raising really significant issues for traditional publishers in dealing with quickening news cycles. How fast should they respond? How do they engage with citizen publishing? Do they try and engage, or do they ignore it? How do they deal with it? It also raises issues of disaggregation. So if this is where people are spending their time, it's possible for other people, other than media companies, politicians, actors, celebrities, to try and bypass traditional media and build relations directly with audiences through these channels. So these are a few examples from the recent UK elections, where some of the heads of digital strategy for the political parties told me openly their long-term aim was to bypass mainstream media. The Conservatives had about 200,000 fans on Facebook for David Cameron and the official Conservative Party site, and about 100,000 followers on Twitter. And they've been developing the Web Cameron brand on YouTube for about 4 years now. And if you look today in terms of the strategic spending review, the government will be using all of these channels as a way of getting their own message out whilst recognising that most people are going to get it through the mainstream media. This is a way in which they can get their message out in an unmediated way without the media involved. And then apart from the politicians, there are a range of... and of course a lot of those ideas came originally from the United States and from Barack Obama, who consistently runs press conferences and tries to use the networks that he built during his campaign to communicate directly, again, without getting the media involved. So this is an example of a press conference around energy, and he was able to drum up through Twitter links 10,000 people to watch that press conference and to be able to talk about it. So another example of the same thing. And then you have, apart from the politicians, you have a range of aggregators who are trying to also engage citizens in these conversations, build relations, and use the content that they create. During the election, we have Facebook's digital election portal, but there are many other examples, from Google News to Demotic. So it's extremely hot area. So what of the mainstream media? How have they been reacting to the changes? And how have they been harnessing the power of personal media and citizen journalism? So as John says, I've been looking at this for a number of years now, and in terms of motivations, I essentially boiled down the motivations to sort of three core areas. So firstly, how can mainstream media organisations use social media, use generated content, citizen journalism, to improve their journalism, to tell better stories? We saw the example of Iran. Building on the idea that Dan Gilmore talked about in his book about 5 years ago, there's always somebody out there who knows more about the story than you do. So how can you harness that collective intelligence? So that's for news gathering, but also for actually sourcing and using the networks to find experts to help you tell those stories in better ways on television or in print. The second motivation is about getting more engagement. So in a world where loyalty can disappear with a click of a mouse, there's so much competition out there, newspapers in particular want a closer relationship with their audiences, and social media is seen as a really good way of achieving that. So if you contribute to the publication or contribute to a broadcaster, then you're more likely to stick with it and come back the next day. It's the basic idea. And the third motivation is distribution. So these networks and technologies, as we've already seen, are proving to be an extraordinarily powerful way of distributing traditional news content. So the BBC gets, I think now, something like 5 million click-throughs from Facebook a month. And some publications get more referrals now from social networks than they do from Google, from search engines. Not many, but some of them do. So we're seeing a real change because this is these are networks through which people can discover your content through personal recommendation. So practically how that's working out. So this comes from the first paper I did, which I did over a year ago now, where I surveyed a number of mainstream media organisations and looked at all the different methods with which they were trying to interact with citizens to use user-generated content. And I'll just talk you through what this rather complicated chart is about. So it's looking at different methods from the traditional message boards at the top, and the blue circles show the extent to which each organisation is focusing on a particular area or not focusing on a particular area, and the arrows on the right show areas where they are, where they said to me that they are planning to invest more time, and areas where they're planning to invest less time in the future. So lots and lots of different things going on there. So traditional message boards, which are generally on the way out, people don't feel there's enough engagement because they're happening in different places, through to commenting on stories, which people have varying views on the value of that. You'll see that news broadcasters in particular, really focusing on that news UGC area, so that's CNN, BBC, really trying to maximise the videos and pictures they can get whenever a story breaks. Newspapers generally find it very hard to compete in that area, so they have been focusing more on non-news UGC, so I'll show you some examples of that in a minute. There's a whole question of blogs, which most people are embracing. Social network functionality, and the other big one at the bottom there is that off-site engagement. So at the time I did this survey, everyone was really understanding the importance of getting their content out, getting their brands out into those social networks and other places where people are spending their time, and thinking about how they can do that effectively whilst protecting their brand. So those were some of the sort of key responses. Let's have just take a few examples of that from different publishers. So you may have heard of the BBC's user-generated content, and basically they employ a team of people to filter and curate all of the reactions to these stories, all of the incoming material, and all the stuff that's going on in social networks. It has about 23 people working on it right now. And this is just one example. It was an experiment during the recent election where people were encouraged to film their views on what they would do if they were prime minister, and the BBC turned that into effectively a video wall of people's comments. The other thing that they did in the election, and they do on most major news stories now, is they have a whole range of different tools which allow them to see into all of the networks, and they're trawling those for really interesting nuggets to put into the BBC's live pages. So live pages are a new development which combine the views of the broadcaster with comments from social media, so from Twitter or from Facebook or SMSs that have been sent in. And it's a kind of, it's a compilation, curation of the best of of what's happening and reactions to what's happening in a single page. They're phenomenally successful in terms of user views. So around the election, to give you one example, Andrew Sparrow, who did the version for The Guardian, the day after the election, got 300,000 unique users to that live blog, which combined all these different elements, which is more people than bought the newspaper on that day, just reading that single page. So this is a very successful format, and it's one that absolutely integrates the citizen's voice into the output. Now, from a sort of news gathering point of view, this was actually described as taking an election night, and the top one there says we're getting reports of long queues at polling stations across the UK. Twitter didn't generate a lot of original stories during the election, but on election night it definitely came into its own, and we started to see the same effects that you saw with things like Iran. So Twitter was full of a range of comments from lots of different polling stations, and of course also the links within Twitter to some of the user-generated videos. So although I never quite understood why, we didn't see any video on the election night programme for about 2 or 3 hours, but if you were on the social networks, you could start to see some of the eyeball stuff coming in. So it's the same kind of issues. And the point about the user-generated hub is because they are engaged in these networks all the time, they have authenticity and trust that they can interact and check the veracity of those things and then build them back into the television programmes or the online output. So that's a sort of a live event and how it works, a live event. But in normal times, the user-generated hub also has journalists who trawl through emails looking for stories and then work with citizens in different parts of the world to turn those into journalism. So they actually have a specialist in South Asia, for example, and part of their role is to work with radio programs to find interviewees from the emails that are coming in, but also to turn them into journalism. There was a ticker issue when this was taken in 2009 from Swat Valley of trying to get reliable eyewitness news out of that. And emails came in, they were able to get back to that person to work with them to produce a really good eyewitness report, which then went to the site. So sometimes this is done with bylines, sometimes it's done in this case with email correspondence, and they're doing a bit of production on it. That's a good example of how mainstream organisation is working with citizens to produce content and then putting it in front of mainstream audiences. CNN do a similar thing. They have a brand called iReport, which is much more citizen reporting platform, so there's much less control and moderation. But they also have people sitting from CNN proper, sitting there with them, trawling through those things, and then working out how they can take some of the best, most newsworthy bits and take it right into the heart of CNN, either into the website or into the television output. So newspapers, I mentioned this earlier, they're running the live pages a lot, and almost all of them did that during the election, continue to do so afterwards because of the success. But they tend to do, as I say, more creative things. So this was a wall that the Times, New York Times, ran of the inauguration of Barack Obama. You could just mouse over the individuals, click into pictures, and sent in that. There was another great example when Michael Jackson died. All over America, Michael Jackson had been pictured with fans, and those were in photograph albums all over America. They said, just go and get them out, scan them in, send them to us. And you had these fantastic memories and pictures and little comments. And it's a really moving tribute that the New York Times working with audiences to get greater engagement and loyalty. The Guardian did a similar thing. So this was during the campaign of 2008. If Obama's going to get elected, you know, tell us your message for Obama. The pictures were really good and really innovative and challenging, and they were published in the G2 section of The Guardian, but they were also turned into a book. So it's a great example of where citizen material went back into what you might call mainstream or print journalism, and actually even back as far as a book. So you may say, well, this is not journalism, this is just citizen submission. But I think many organisations are trying to go a little bit further. And one of the most interesting developments last year was around the MP's expenses scandal, when all of these documents were published at very short notice online, almost 500,000 documents. And it doesn't really scale for a newspaper to get people to sit through and read all those documents to find where there might be some stories. So the idea was, could we get our readers to do this, and could we make it a bit of a game? So the online application helped people through. There was even a league table for people who read the most documents or produced the most leads. The idea was that stories that emerged from reading these things, or things that might be stories, were flagged up, and those things were then investigated by traditional journalists. So it's a bit like the example I showed earlier of Dean Tomlinson. It's about how traditional journalism and some of these new crowdsourcing techniques can work together, that I think is where there's a real sweet spot for mainstream organisations. I think it's not unlike the user-generated hub and the sort of thing it does, and I think that a lot of news organisations are now, not necessarily in a formal way, but de facto, starting to set up these sort of liaison specialists who understand how to do this. And I think in the future, a lot of newsrooms will be working in partnership in this way. So there'll be a sort of filtering desk, and there'll be a group of people who specialise in taking the leads and turning them into journalism for those publications. I think that's going to be a trend we're going to see over the next 5 to 10 years, and be just a part of news organisations in the future. And then there are a lot of examples. Again, mainstream media is not the only one doing this. Many examples of similar crowdsourcing of citizen material around news events. This was Ushahidi, which is a platform to enable this to happen, and started in Kenya at the time of the elections, and was used to plot protests after the elections in Kenya. Has now developed into a publishing platform which is used a lot by aid agencies, in this case by during the Haiti aftermath of the Haiti quake, and all of these behind these red dots were eyewitness reports, and they're trying to develop that with particularly the aid community at the moment. One final one, not from mainstream, this comes again from the elections. This again is crowdsourcing, and what this organisation did, again it's a non-profit, was trying to crowdsource leaflets essentially. So using a network of civic volunteers and saying, wouldn't it be great if you could upload all of the election leaflets? So mostly election leaflets are of less high quality and can be embarrassing to national politicians because they can be very partisan. But because they're not visible, people get away with it. So the idea was, if we could make this more transparent, if we can digitise it, put it online, use all these network people to do so, we will find stories and we will force improved quality in local election leaflets. So I can't remember how they did, but it's documented in the paper that I did. But it's certainly what emerged was a number of embarrassing stories, one of which featured in the leadership debates. So I think it's an interesting example of the same kind of thing, and if mainstream media organisations don't get involved in this, other people will do it. So it's an interesting example. I think that one of the, going back to the mainstream media, I think one of the biggest trends is the way in which at the beginning it was felt that, these tools, they're not for mainstream media, they're for other people, and it's kind of one against the other. And I think one of the changes we've seen is the way in which mainstream media has said, actually, don't see why that should be the case, and they've broadly adopted these tools and techniques themselves, and in the process created new kinds of relationships. So a really good example is Nick Kristof, who's one of the early pioneers of the New York Times, a Pulitzer Prize winner. And not only did he write blogs and all the rest of it, but he also used his YouTube channel to reach out to and have competitions for young people to go on him with a foreign assignment. So they had to come up with some piece of video, and the best one was selected and went to Sudan, and then came back, and that went onto the YouTube channel, but also the content went into the New York Times itself. So, another example of essentially the same techniques being used by mainstream media journalists. Robert Peston, I talk about a lot. He's a pretty traditional journalist in many ways, but I think one of the best bloggers who really does take his audience seriously. And he's interesting because he loves his blog, he regularly updates it, he talks about it being the centre of everything he does. And he's absolutely serious about breaking stories on his blog at the same time as television and radio. And it's about the whole thing together for him. It's about the journalism, not about an individual individual medium. And for him, this is really providing a daily connection. And I think as a print journalist coming to BBC, he felt a bit disconnected because he would only get his television paper every 2 or 3 days. And for him, as a journalist, just being connected, what the blog gives him is that connection to all the connections to the story all of the time. So one thing that's happened less in this space is the mainstream media providing a space for citizen journalism to practice. The Telegraph set up an area called My Telegraph, which they've just relaunched, where people can write about anything, and they have the Telegraph doesn't try and control what they do. They maybe guide and help a little bit, but in general, this is not producing news. This is mainly around sort of comment and softer topics. The BBC runs similar spaces for sport, where people can write articles, football reviews, which has been pretty successful. But again, it doesn't really apply in the sort of core news areas. And in the UK, we have Comment is Free, The Guardian's Comment is Free, but this is something slightly different. In this case, the contributors are selected by The Guardian and for the most part paid, Huffington Post similar. Although it started with a whole load of unpaid bloggers, it's actually becoming much more about paying people, and they just announced recently they're taking on another 30 staff and they're going to write more original content. So in a sense, a lot of those dreams about, well, you can just do it all with unpaid citizen journalism, in the reality, although the Huffington Post is an incredibly successful organisation, is now overtaking the Washington Post in terms of unique numbers. In fact, overtook the Washington Post in 2009. It is actually a model which is about the benefits of curation and quality and selecting things for audiences, which I think is quite interesting. I think the model is one that is much more interactive and much more open, and still uses a lot of unpaid bloggers as well, but it's the fastest growing publication, or was the fastest growing publication in the United States, very successful and now highly profitable. So I think one of the things that this tells us is that there's just much less clarity about what journalism is and what citizen journalism and what is semi-professional journalism, because in a publication like The Huffington Post, all of those things apply, and it's not necessarily obvious who's a citizen journalist, who's getting paid, who isn't getting paid. Is that a bad thing? Is it a good thing? I don't know, but it's happening. One other trend, related trend, which has emerged in the last year or so is the so-called search-driven content farms. So this is where contributors write articles based on what people are searching for. So this is the ultimate, give people what they want. So that may be antibiotic treatments for bad breath. And you log on, you're paid something like $5 or $7 per article, and an algorithm tells you what to write. Which is normally something to do with health or cats or whatever people are searching for. You may sneer, it's now these sites are in the top 20 content sites in the United States, and content farms are coming to the UK this year. So Yahoo has just announced that it's opening Sport Associate, which is a big content farm company, and is planning to develop a lot more of this content. So give more people what they want, get a lot of journalism students write this kind of stuff to earn a little bit of money. So this has obviously created some outrage in the journalism profession, but it seems to me in many ways it's an inevitable result of the changing laws of supply and demand. So if the cost of producing something falls to virtually zero, which it does with many of these publishing platforms, then it's worth producing something even if only a few people read it. So previously, it wouldn't have been worth the printing cost to put some of these articles in a publication, but now that no longer applies. So this clearly can be a good thing or a bad thing, depends how it's used. I think one of the potential positives is in hyperlocal and local citizen journalism. Traditional newspapers are never going to have the staff, for example, to cover every boy's under 11 football game, but in collaboration with their parents, using models like this, it may well be possible to produce a comprehensive service for free using these new tools. So I think it's a question, it's not good or bad, it's a question of how you use these new tools and these new changes to the economics. So going back to our local site, this is exactly what's happening in certain areas, like local history. Fantastic series of really well-researched articles and pictures about which plots day by day where the bombs landed in a particular area 40 years ago against a map that also gives details of the pictures. So no one's getting paid for this. It's content that previously wouldn't have been printed, but when the costs of production fall, this material's available. So I think the real question is how mainstream media deals with this, particularly in the hyperlocal area. So is it going to allow networks of local sites like these to emerge, or will other players like Yahoo, who are interested in this kind of thing, effectively move into the space that previously been occupied by local and regional newspapers here in the UK, for example? Will local publishers be able to curate a community? Will they have the right attitudes to curate and work with a community rather than just trying to broadcast to them? And there are various experiments going on at the moment. This is one that the New York Times is engaged with in conjunction with New York University. And it's the same. So this is actually with the help and support and under the umbrella of the New York Times, and they're trying some hyperlocal to see how the relationships can work, but obviously also making sure it's separate and branded and it has its own its power to get on with its own storytelling. So what does this all add up to, and where's it going into the future? So just three closing thoughts, really. So the first one, and I've kind of mentioned this before, it's not sort of one replacing the other, it's not either or, it's both. And a few years ago, there was this real battle going on between new media and old media, people arguing that the walls should come tumbling down, journalism needed completely reinventing, maybe typified by this film, you may have seen it, called State of Play, where the old-fashioned hack won out over the up-and-coming blogger, Della Fry, who played Fast and Loose with the Truth. But I think that in the film, the old-fashioned stuff won and everyone cheered and went home happy. But in reality, it is much more of an accommodation and recognition that it's not either or, it's both. Citizen journalism doesn't replace journalism, they work together, as in the case of Ian Tomlinson or another recent case, Guido Fawkes, who broke a fairly big story here in the UK about one of the aides to the Prime Minister, but he broke it not on his own blog but in the Telegraph because he needed the mainstream audience, and the two worked together in a symbiotic way. So I think that's kind of one of the first thoughts is about recognition of the complementary nature of this and then embracing of those possibilities. I think the second thing is that moderation is good. This is a very rare case during the election where things didn't go quite as well. So in this particular case, this doesn't happen very often anymore. This was a rather rude comment about David Cameron that was relayed live to an audience of 6 million people immediately after the first debate.
What does it say?
I can't say, it's too rude. You're a first class, Clegg Clegg puts your ignorance to shame. So that was a rude comment about David Cameron. So that went out live to 6 million people. And that kind of thing happened a lot. And I think there is now a new confidence that the audience understands and expects a consistent level of quality, whether they're reading a ITV story or reading comments on the ITV. The full back channel is available over there, but for mainstream organisations, actually quality, moderation, standards are important. And knowing where those dividing lines are is something the mainstream media was uncertain about for a while, but I think it's clear. So this is kind of the exception that proves the rule. Steve Herman, who's the editor of the BBC News website, said this just before the election. And it is about those expectations, you know, that I think that not only mainstream organisations, but also audiences have come to realise what they want out of mainstream media, that they actually value the interactivity, they value the comments, but the fact that they're selected and that they're not just bombarded with everything in a context of mainstream media brand is important. And the fact that, you know, exclusives aren't in there and that these things are family friendly and all the rest of it are also important. And there's absolutely a new confidence. So where people talk about moderation as being something that you know, wasn't true to the spirit of the web, you don't hear that anymore in mainstream organisations. Moderation is okay, moderation is good. And the final thing is really it's about journalism as conversation. So the fact that sort of bringing it all together, really, that journalism is not, as Alan Rushbridge just says, a reassessment of whether journalists are the only people who are the figures of authority in the world. So a reassessment of that dividing line between definitive journalism and commentators on the one hand, and bloggers, and it's not sort of an either-or, it's about more of a continuum. And then this whole question that he talks about in terms of a mutual conversation, a mutual relationship, opening your site up, that the journalism itself will be improved if you allow other voices in, if you open up and stop trying to pretend that you're the high priest and that you know everything, and that there is all of those possibilities. So for me, this is you know, that's a slightly different view from the Steve Herman view, but I don't think they're incompatible. I think it's an exciting time where there's going to be, and there is, you know, a huge amount of experimentation about where the boundaries should lie. But I think it's the time when we find out how those new partnerships are going to work, and I think we're seeing, as in some of those examples, some real practical iteration of how you can move from a whole load of comments to really intelligent crowdsourcing, for example, of MPs' expenses to produce genuine stories where traditional journalists and social journalists work. And all of that is going to take time to work out. But I think the key outcome will be that we'll be using these tools to add much more value in the next 5 years.